Chapter 15. The Death Guard captain entered the tiers of the fortress's massive infirmary, and inside he found his way to the ward where Decius was being held. He approached the isolation chamber. Along with the dedication plaque that Kariah had taken with him, it remained the only other component of the starship Eisenstein that had survived the frigate's destruction. Huge cargo servitors had physically disconnected the module from the vessel's valetudinarium and transplanted it to here, where Dawn's Medicaid could turn their skills to the warrior's injuries. The apothecaries of the Imperial Fists had met with no more success than those of the Death Guard. Through the walls of the glass pod, Decius seemed closer than ever to his end. The livid knife wound was a sink for his colour and complexion, fingers of pallid corpse flesh reaching out from the injury, seeping sores collected at the corners of Decius's lips and nostrils, and his eyes were gummed shut with dried runnels of pus. The infection from whatever poison had soaked Grulgor's debased blade was overcoming the defences of the young Astartes, moment by agonising moment. Garrow became aware of someone standing close by. He saw Voyan's face reflected in the glass wall.
"He has spoken once or twice. His words were largely incoherent."
The other man was muted, as if he were afraid to speak to the captain.
"He calls out war cries and battle orders in his delirium."
Garrow nodded.
"He's fighting the disease just as he would any other adversary."
"There is little we can do," Voyan admitted. "The virus has moved to an airborne stage of contagion in recent days, and we cannot enter the chamber to minister to him, even in fully sealed power armour. I have done what I can to ease his pain, but he's on his own."
"The Emperor will protect him," murmured Garrow.
"We can only hope so. Captain Sigismund has given orders that every aspect of Decius's malady is to be examined and documented by the Phalanx's Medicaid staff. In case the intruders we encountered on the Eisenstein return. I have told them everything I witnessed."
"Good."
Garrow turned to leave.
"Carry on."
"Lord."
Voyan blocked his path, his head bowed.
"We must speak."
He offered the battle captain his combat blade.
"On the bridge, before you triggered the warp flare, I challenged you, and I see now that I was wrong to do so. You promised us rescue, and it came. Such defiance as mine cannot go without censure."
He looked up.
"I have betrayed your trust twice. I will accept whatever punishment you will mete out. My life is yours."
Garrow took the knife and held it for a long moment.
"What you have done, Merrick, with the lodges and on the Eisenstein did not fall from any malice in your character. These things you did through fear. Fear of the unknown."
He handed back the weapon.
"I will not punish you for that. You are my battle brother, and your challenges are why I have you at my side."
He touched Voyan on the shoulder.
"Never be afraid again, Merrick. Look to the Emperor as I have done. Know him, and you will know no fear."
On an impulse, he drew out Caleb's tracts and pressed them into Voyan's palm.
"You may find, as I have, some measure of significance in these."
Coded astropathic signals had gone before the Phalanx, high-level protocols that called to alert the most secure levels of the Imperium's forces in the Sol system. Dawn's authority was enough to set ships in motion and for troops to be put to a higher state of readiness. And there were other forces at work as well, agencies that had sensed the arrival of the Star Fortress and the precious cargo it carried. Several light minutes inside the orbit of Eris, the Phalanx exploded from a warp gate with violent concussion, sending sheets of exotic lightning radiating out and away into the void. Delicate sensory devices dotting the surface of the 10th planet registered the new arrival and immediately communicated reports to relay stations on Pluto and Uranus, where in turn they would be sent onward by Astropath to Terra and her dominions. The return of the Imperial Fists to humanity's cradle was long overdue. By rights, there should have been celebrations and great ceremony on many of the outer colonies of the solar system to mark it. Instead, the phalanx came in with speed and ruthless purpose, not in a stately cruise about the solar system's outlying worlds. The mammoth craft did not fly the pennants and banners associated with the triumphant arrival of a heroic vessel. Instead, the colours on her masts and the laser lamps about the phalanx's circumference were lit for urgency. Patrol ships made way, no captain daring to challenge the master of the Imperial Fists for his haste. Drives flaring like captured stars, the fortress vessel passed in through the ragged edges of the Oort cloud at three-quarters the speed of light, down into the plane of the ecliptic, crossing the orbit of Neptune in a flicker of dazzling radiation. Once again, Garrow was summoned to Dorne's chambers. At the rear of the great hall, massive iron panels folded away into the ornate walls, revealing a glass bowl that looked down to the command nexus of the fortress below. It was like the bridge of any starship, but magnified 100-fold in size and scope. Garrow was reminded of a stadium, with concentric rings of operator consoles raised in staggered tiers over an arena in the middle. The central portion of the command deck was a gallery of hololithic displays, some of them 4 stories tall, forever glittering and shifting. Statues of armor-clad Astartes in the war gear of the Imperial Fists were ranged along the sides of the Nexus, arms out as if they held Dorne's observation bowl at their fingertips. On this level, repeater consoles were arranged so that the Primarch and his officers could draw information from any post in the Nexus with a single word of instruction. Garrow realized that from this high vantage point, a single general would be able to direct an entire war of millions of men and thousands of starships. He acknowledged Cruz, where the Lunar Wolf stood in conversation with Captain Efried, and bowed before Dorn.
You sent for me, Lord.
I have something for you to see.
The Primarch nodded to Holbrecht, a tall Imperial Fist with a sharp face and a shaved skull.
Show the battle captain our new escort.
Holbrecht touched a control and a picked screen emerged from the broad console. Garrow saw an image of Void outside the phalanx's hull, and of a large dark silhouette that moved in echelon with it. The structure of the other vessel was only defined by the places where it blotted out the stars. A black ship.
The Aerea Gloris.
It was unmistakable, and the instant Garrow seized on the configuration, his mind filled in the empty spaces. He had no doubt it was the same craft that had appeared near Iota Horologi.
Correct, said Dorn. This phantom joined us as we cleared the shadow of Neptune and fell in to match us in course and speed. They brought with them orders from the Council of Terra itself and directions to harbour. Specific reference was made to you, Captain, and the woman, Keela. You will tell me why.
Garrow hesitated, unsure of how to proceed.
I have had dealings with Amandera Kendall, a senior Oblivion Knight among the Silent Sisterhood, he began.
Dorn shook his head once, a curt gesture of command.
Your dealings with these untouchables do not concern me, Garrow. What troubles me is that they know Keela is aboard my ship, and they have bid me to have her isolated.
Garrow felt a surge of concern.
Euphrates Keela is no threat to the Phalanx, sir. She is a gifted individual.
Gifted?
Dorn made the word a growl.
I know the kinds of gifts that the Sisterhood come seeking. Have you brought a mind witch aboard my fortress, Deathguard? Does this remembrancer bear the mark of the Psyker?
He grimaced.
I was there at Nykaia when the Emperor himself censured the use of these warp-spawned powers for the good of the Imperium. I will not allow such forces to run unchecked among my warriors.
She is no witch, Lord, Garrow retorted. If anything, her gift is that she has felt the Emperor's touch more keenly than any one of us.
The tremor in his voice drew Cruz's attention, and the Lunar Wolf came closer.
"We shall see. Sister Amandira has requested that Keela be kept under lock and key, and Holbrecht's men have placed a guard upon her. The woman and her cohorts will be turned over to the Sisters of Silence once we make orbit at Luna." "Sir, I cannot permit that."
The words streamed from him before he could stop himself.
"They are under my protection." "And mine," broke in Cruz. "Lokan entrusted their safety to me personally."
"What you wish and what you will permit are of no interest to the Imperial Fists," snapped Holbrecht,
stepping up to face Garrow.
"You are guests of the Seventh Legion, and you will conduct yourselves as such."
"You labour under a misapprehension, both of you," said Dorn, moving to the windows. "Have you forgotten what you said to me? The Death Guard and the Sons of Horus have turned against the Emperor, and if so, then their legions are soon to be declared renegade, as will all their warriors, protectorates, and crews in service."
"We risked everything to bring the warning."
Garrow's words were brittle ice.
"And now you all but name us traitor?"
"I say only what some already have, what others will. Why do you think we travel to make port at the lunar base instead of taking orbit about Terra? I will not risk the lives of the Council and the Emperor on a whim."
Cruz spat angrily, the old warrior's normally reticent manner melting away.
"Forgive me, Lord Dorn, but did you not see the Lady Olaton's mnemonic recording? Are not the sworn words of 70 Astartes proof enough for you?"
70 Astartes whose legions have turned their backs on Terra,"
said Ephriat grimly. The Primarch nodded.
"Understand my position. Despite all the evidence you bring me, I cannot be certain of this until I see it through the eyes of an Imperial Fist. I do not call you liars, brothers, but I must see all sides of this, consider every possibility."
"What if you are the traitors here?"
demanded Holbrecht.
"Suppose Horus has been laid low by some conspiracy among his own men, and you have been sent to assassinate the Emperor."
Garrow's hand fell to the hilt of Libertas.
"I have killed men for lesser insults, Imperial Fist. Pray tell, how could we do such an impossible thing?"
"Perhaps by bringing a witch psyker to Terra in secret,"
said Ephriad,
"or a man racked with a plague that no medicine can defeat."
Ice formed in Garrow's chest, and the anger left him in a cold rush.
"No, no!"
He turned to Dorn.
"Lord, if what I have told you and shown you is not enough to convince you, then I beg to know what it will take. Must I fall upon my own blade before you believe me?"
"I have this hour spoken to the Imperial Regent, Malkador the Sigillite, via machine call vox,"
said the Primarch.
"It was my affirmation to him that, despite the dedication you have shown to the Emperor in braving the gauntlet to carry forth your warning, the Council of Terra cannot be fully certain where the loyalties of such men ultimately lie."
There was a hard edge to Dorn's voice, but for the first time Garrow sensed the tension in him. It was not easy for the Primarch to utter such words to fellow Astartes.
"My orders were to return to Terra to bulwark the planet's defences, and it seems that I may have to do that in order to resist my own brothers."
He glanced at Garrow.
"I will attend the Imperial Palace and brief the Emperor on this grave news. You, the refugees from the Vengeful Spirit, and all the Astartes from the Eisenstein, will remain in secure holding at the Somnus Citadel on Luna until our master decides what your fate will be."
Slowly and carefully, Garrow drew his sword and turned it in his grip, offering the weapon to Dorn just as Voyen had offered his combat knife to Garrow.
"Take my sword, and end me with it if I am a deceiver, Lord. I implore you, for I grow weary of each test that is heaped upon us. With all the lies and distrust that have bombarded me, I cannot face the same from those I call kinsmen."
With his free hand, Garrow reached up to his chest and touched the eagle cuirass. He nodded to the Primarch's armor and the similar aegis there, both echoes of the war gear worn by the Master of Mankind.
"We both carry the mark of the Emperor's Aquila. Does that count for so little?"
"In these dark times, nothing can be certain.
Dawn's face turned to stone once again.
Put away your weapon and be silent, Battle Captain Garrow. Know this. If you resist the Edict of the Sigillite in any way, then the full and unfettered wrath of the Imperial Fists will be set upon you and your cohorts.
We will not resist, Garrow said, defeated. If this is what must be done, then so be it.
Libertas returned to its sheath in silence. The Primarch turned away.
We will arrive in a few hours. Assemble your men and be ready to disembark.
The distance across the marble floor to the chamber's doors seemed to expand as Garrow's injured leg tensed with ghostly pain on every step he took. The phalanx approached Luna through the hanging ornaments of orbital defense stations and commerce platforms, her path an open corridor through the darkness towards Terra's natural satellite. As the fortress of the Imperial Fists found harbor at the gravity null Lagrange point beyond the moon, the phalanx mimicked the orbit of Luna around its parent world. Once, the satellite had been a mottled stone wasteland, where humans had ventured in their first infantile steps away from their birth world. They had built colonies there, testing their mettle in the pitiless cold of the void in preparation for future voyages to other planets. But as Terra's people had advanced, Luna had become little more than a way station, a place to pass by on the journey to the interplanetary and later interstellar deeps. For a time, in the age of strife, when Terra was engulfed in war and blood, the moon had become desolate and empty once again. But after the rise of the Emperor, Luna had known a rebirth. Waxing and waning, the satellite came full circle as the Age of Imperium brought it new life. Bisecting the great stone sphere across its equator lay a man-made valley many kilometers wide. This was the Circuit, an artificial canyon that laid open the rock and stone beneath the dusty lunar surface. All along the length of the chasm lay gateways into the moon's interior, vast doors to the honeycomb of spaces carved by mankind in the heart of Luna. The ancient, dead boulder of the moon became the largest military complex ever built by humans. A vast shipyard for the armada of the Imperium. Thousands of starships, from the smallest shuttle to the largest battle barge, were built and maintained there. And across the face of the far side, there were complex stations for observation of the great void beyond. Port Luna was the cold stone heart of humankind's great fleets. The satellite was as much a weapon as it was a safe harbor. Much of the metals mined from the moon's heart and the rock from the circuit's excavation had been employed by the Emperor's most skilled engineers, fashioned into a synthetic ring that girdled the planetoid. The vast grey hoop held batteries of lance cannons and docking bays for more warships. Wherever the light from Luna fell, those who saw it could sleep soundly, knowing the ceaseless guardian stood to their defence. And beyond it, Terra. The cradle of humanity was in darkness. The light of the sun glimmered around the curvature of the planet, a brilliant arc of golden colour. Terra's night side showed its face towards Luna, the features of her continents and towering hive city constructs largely hidden beneath thick storm fronts and haze. In the places where the cloud formations were thin enough, the pulsing spark of lights from the great metropolis arcologies made necklaces of stark white and bright blue, some clustered in halos, others extending out along coastlines for hundreds of kilometers. Dark patches where the oceans lay shimmered like spilled ink. On the yellow-hued stormbird that carried the first group of the Eisenstein 70, Nathaniel Garrow detached himself from his acceleration cradle and made his way to a viewport, ignoring the neutral stares from Captain Holbrecht and his men. He pressed his head close to the hemisphere of armor glass and looked with naked eyes upon the planet of his birth. How long had it been? Time seemed to weigh so much more upon him than it had before. Garrow estimated that it had been several decades since he had last seen Imperial Terror's majesty. There was a pang of sadness. In the dark of night, he could not hope to pick out the terrain formations and landmarks that he had learned so readily as a youth. Would there be men down there, looking up as he stared out on them, Garrow wondered. Perhaps a boy, no more than 15 summers, out in the wild agri-parks of Albia for the first time in his life, would be staring up into the night sky and marvelling at the impossible magnitude of the stars. Turning there below, somewhere beneath him, was the place where he had been born, and all the other landscapes of his childhood. Down there was the heart of the Imperium, great complexes of infinite majesty and achievement, like the Red Mountain, the Libraria Ultima, the Petitioner's City, and the Imperial Palace itself, where even now the Emperor resided. It was so close, Garrow felt like he could reach out and take it in his armoured fingers. He pressed his gauntlet to the window, and his palm covered the planet completely.
"If only it were that simple to keep it safe," said Haker.
The sergeant joined him at the viewport. In spite of everything, Garrow felt strangely cheered by the sight of his home world, even as his emotions pulled him towards melancholy.
"As long as Juan Astartes still draws breath, old friend, Terror will never fall."
"I would prefer not to be that Juan Astartes," replied Haker. "With each passing day, we are isolated further still."
"Aye," the Death Guard reflected.
Time indeed was passing more swiftly than he had anticipated. While the Eisensteins' escape, becalming and rescue, had seemed like little more than a matter of weeks for those on board, Garrow soon discovered that their subjective period did not marry with the passing of days elsewhere. According to the central chronometer broadcast from the Imperial capital, more than twice as much time had passed since the attack on Istvan III. Once more, Garrow spared a thought for the loyalists left behind to face the guns of Horus. The Stormbird turned and dipped its nose towards Luna, filling the viewport with spans of hard white stone the same shade as Garrow's marble-hued armour. They were falling towards the Rhaetia Valley, and beyond it the Mare Chryseum, the Sea of Chryses, where the Silent Sisterhood kept their secure lunar citadel. Garrow caught movement from the corner of his eye, the yellow of an Imperial fist going forward from the aft compartment. Haker saw him notice.
"I dislike being treated like a novitiate on my first mission off-world," he said quietly. "We don't need escorts, not from these humourless dullards."
"It is by Dorne's orders," Garrow replied,
although he said it with little conviction.
"Are we prisoners now, Captain? Have we come so far only to be clapped in irons and stowed away in some lunar dungeon?"
Garrow eyed him.
"We are not prisoners, Sergeant Haker. Our war gear and weapons still remain in our possession."
The veteran snorted.
"Only because Dorne's men think we are no threat to them. Look there, sir."
He nodded at the warriors at the far end of the compartment.
"They pretend to be at ease, but they are too stiff to carry it off. I see the patterns of their movements through the ship. They walk as if they are on guard duty, and we are their charges."
"Perhaps so," admitted Garrow. "But I believe it is more that Captain Holbrecht fears what we represent than who we are. I saw his face when Dorne revealed the truth of the War Master's deceit. He could not comprehend it."
"That may be, Lord, but the tension grinds like blades upon me."
He looked around.
"It's an insult to us. They separated us, placed the Lunar Wolf with Voyen and the boy Decius's capsule on another shuttle, and I never saw what happened to the Iterator and the women."
Garrow pointed at something through the viewport.
"We're all going to the same place, Andus. Look there."
Outside, the sheer brass tower of the Somnus Citadel turned to meet the descending dropship. As they came closer, Garou saw that the building was made from hundreds of gates, one atop the other, arrayed like the faceplates of the golden helmets of the Silent Sisters. The Stormbird fell into a spiralling turn, orbiting around the tower. A dome became visible in the floor of the vast crater beyond, and slowly it opened, triangular segments drawing back to present a concealed landing field.
"We are on final approach to the citadel," said Holbrecht. "Take your seats."
"What if I wish to stand?" replied Haker, open defiance in his tone.
"Sergeant," warned Garou, and waved him to his place.
"Are all your subordinates so obstreperous?"
grumbled the other captain.
"Of course," said Garou, returning to his acceleration couch. "We are Death Guard. It's our nature."
The Stormbird's hatch yawned open, and Garou strode out down the drop ramp, catching Holbrecht unaware. Protocol meant that, as it was an Imperial Fists ship, an Imperial Fist should have been first down the ramp, but Garou was finding less and less use for such pointless etiquette. A cadre of Silent Sisters was waiting for them in a careful formation on the landing apron. Garou glanced around, up over the folding wings of the Stormbird to the open hatch far above. The soap bubble shimmer of a porous aura field was visible, holding the atmosphere inside the chamber, but allowing objects of high mass like the ships to pass through unencumbered. A second Stormbird was dropping in behind on jets of retro thrust, and out in the void a third ship was approaching, twinkling with indicator lights, but too distant to see in any detail. The Astartes came to a halt and bowed to the sisters.
"Nathaniel Garou, battle captain of the Death Guard. By order of the Primarch Rogel Dorn, I am here."
Holbrecht and his guards came down heavily after him, and Garou felt the annoyance radiating off them. He kept his eyes on the sisters. Their squad markings varied among the group, and he searched for some that matched those of the Storm Dagger Cadre. Garou saw the same kinds of warriors as he had on the Yorghali worldship, but with stylistic differences upon their armour in the same fashion as those of the various Legiones Astartes. One group wore armour detailed in wintry silver, the lower halves of their faces hidden behind spiked guards that resembled a barrier fence. Another woman, standing to the edge of the group, had no armour at all. Rather, she was clad in a thick, buckle-studded coat of blood-red leather, with matching gauntlets and a high collar ranged around her neck. The woman had no eyes. In their place were two augmetics, heavy lenses of ruby-coloured glass fixed to the skin of her brow and cheeks with hair-fine wires. She studied Garou with all the warmth of a chirurgeon, observing a cancer beneath a microscope. With an abrupt sensation, Garou felt a chill range deep through his bones. It was the same odd feeling he had encountered when he saw Sister Amandira in the Endurance's assembly chamber, the same peculiar absence of something indefinable. Only now he felt surrounded by it, the disquiet pressing in on him from every side.
"Battle Captain Garou, well met," said a familiar voice.
A slight figure in robes dropped back her hood, and he recognised the novice girl he had spoken to before.
"And to you as well, Holbrecht of the Imperial Fists. The Silent Sisterhood welcomes you to the Somnus Citadel. It saddens us that your arrival must come under such difficult circumstances."
Garou hesitated. He wasn't sure how much the sisters knew of the Istvan situation, or what Dorn and the Sigilite had communicated to them. He covered with a salute.
"Sister, I thank you for granting us a haven while these matters are addressed."
It was a lie, of course. Garou did not wish to be here, and neither did his men. But the Sisterhood had proven themselves worthy of his respect, and he saw no need to begin this meeting on an adversarial note. He had taken his fill of such behaviour with the Imperial Fists.
"Where is your mistress?"
The novice girl's neutral expression faltered for a moment, and Garou saw her give the woman in the red coat a sideways glance.
"She will attend us momentarily."
The rest of Garou's men from the first Stormbird had fallen in behind him, and under Haker's command presented a parade ground formation. Holbrecht stood at Garou's shoulder and eyed him.
"Captain," he said with formality, "a word?"
Yes.
The Imperial Fist's eyes narrowed, but not in annoyance, as Garrow expected. Hallbreck showed what might have passed for compassion.
I know what you must think of us. I can only begin to comprehend what you have experienced. If it is true.
Garrow could almost hear the silent addendum.
Do not think ill of my Primarch. These orders he has given are to preserve the security of the Imperium. If the price of that is a wound to your honour, then I hope you will see it as a small one to pay.
Garrow met his gaze.
My kinsmen have betrayed me. My master has turned traitor. My honour brothers are dead, and my legion is on the path to corruption. My honour, Captain Hallbrecht, is all I have left.
He turned away as the second Stormbird settled into place with jets of spent thruster gas. The other transport opened along its flanks, and servitors scurried out with the isolation capsule in their grip. Voyen walked in lockstep with them. As Garrow watched, a contingent of silent sisters, all of them armed with powerful inferno guns, formed a guard around the module as it was carried past them.
"Where are you taking him?"
he asked.
"The Somnus Citadel has many functions, and our hospitallers are highly skilled," said the novice. "Perhaps they may have success where the Medicae of the Astartes did not."
"Decius is not a Xenos corpse to be poked and dissected," Garrow replied tersely, his thoughts returning to the alien psychochild. "You will treat him with the respect a Death Guard is due."
Sendek and Cruz approached, joining Haker's formation with the last of the men.
"Be still, lad," said the Lunar Wolf. "Your boy is not dead yet. Still he clings on to bloody life even now. I've rarely seen a fighting spirit of the like."
Garrow grunted, his mood darkening. At last the final vessel dropped down into the chamber and turned, landing struts extending from the spread wings and fuselage. He recognized the shuttle, the black and gold livery identical to the ship from the Aerea Gloris he had spied on the landing deck of the Endurance. The swan-like ship settled gently on the apron and fell silent. Garrow knew instinctively who he would see aboard before the egress hatch opened. A ramp extruded from the ventral hull, and a handful of figures disembarked. Leading them was Amandira Kendall, her proud and noble bearing somewhat muted. She seemed distracted and wary. Two more of Kendall's Storm Dagger Witch-Seekers marshalled the other passengers from behind. Kirill Sinderman, Mercedes Oleton, and at their head, Euphrati Keeler. Keeler's gaze crossed the chamber and found Garrow. She gave him a nod of greeting that seemed almost regal. He had expected her to appear afraid, as nervous as Oleton and the old iterator obviously were, but Keeler stepped down into the citadel as if she were fated to be there, as if she were the mistress of the place. Sister Amandira did something in sign language, and the unblinking woman in the red coat and her cohorts moved with sudden, graceful swiftness.
"An excruciatus," said Hallbrecht of the woman. "It is said that each one of them must personally burn 100 witches before they can take the rank."
Keeler stood, unruffled, as the prosecutor squad approached her. With exaggerated caution, the sister excruciatus gave Euphrati a cold and clinical once-over, looking her up and down. Then she signed to Kendall and gestured sharply to her warriors, who surrounded the refugees. Both Garrow and Cruz came forward at the same moment, ready to step to battle if events fell that way.
"These people are under my aegis," barked the Death Guard. "Those who harm them will face me."
Sister Amandira and her witch-seekers stepped in to block the Astartes' path, but it was Keeler who gave them pause.
"Nathaniel, Yakton, please don't interfere. I will go with them. It is necessary."
The woman in the red coat signed, and the novice translated.
"This one demonstrates traits that are of issue to the Sisterhood. By the Emperor's edicts and the decree of Nikea, we have the authority to do with her as we wish. You have no right of claim in this place, Astartes."
"And the civilians? A documentarist and an iterator?" snapped Cruz. "Are you free to take them as well?"
"Wherever Euphrati goes, we will accompany her,"
Mercedes managed a defiant interjection, and Garrow saw Cinderman nod in agreement. Keeler began to walk.
"Don't be afraid for us," she called. "Have faith. The Emperor will protect."
Garrow watched the procession of figures disappear down a ramp and through a thick iris of steel leaves that slammed closed behind them. He could not shake the sudden icy certainty that he would never see them again. Amandira Kendall was still in front of him, still studying him with iron eyes. She signed again.
"Captain Garrow and the men under your stewardship know this,"
the novice translated in a clear, crisp voice.
"We grant you sanctuary here until such time as the Master of Mankind makes ruling on what shall be done with you. Quarters have been prepared."
The silent sister never once broke eye contact with him.
"You are our guests, and you will be treated as such. In return, we ask that you behave only as the warriors of the Legionis Astartes should, with honour and respect."
The novice paused.
"Captain, she asks you for your word."
It seemed like an eternity before Nathaniel answered.
"She has it."
It was a prison, in any real sense of the word. There were no bars upon the windows, no locked doors on the Spartan tier of the citadel where the sisters gave them quarters in which to wait. But outside was barren rock and airless void, and for kilometres in all directions there were autonomous sensor units and gun drones. If they left the spire, where could they go? Steal a ship from the launch bay? And then what? Garrow sat in his small chamber in silence and listened to the men of the 70 as they talked among themselves. All of them gave voice to the things that churned inside their minds, thoughts of what futures lay before them, fears born of desperation, and plans that went nowhere and did nothing. Sister Amandira was no fool. He saw the look in her eyes. He knew, as well as she did, that if the Astartes of the Eisenstein decided that their confinement was at an end, there would be little the Sisters of Silence could do to stop them from leaving. Garrow was certain that Kendall's warriors would make it a costly path for them, but he estimated he would lose no more than 10 of his men, and probably only the ones who had been slowed by injury during the escape from Istvan. He knew the phalanx was still nearby, and Dawn with it. Perhaps if they did try to leave, the Primarch would send Holbrecht and Ephried to convince them otherwise. Garrow frowned. Yes, that was a sensible tactic, and Dawn was nothing if not the master of level-headed strategy. Stepping back for a moment to examine the situation, Garrow had to give the Lord of the Imperial Fists his due for handling the Eisenstein men in the manner he had. If Garrow and the others had remained on the Star Fortress, eventually friction would have flared and blood would have been shed. By placing them here, under the roof of the Sisterhood, and the very same women who had fought alongside them only months ago, Dawn forced Garrow to give pause to any thoughts of unfettered combat. Even if they fought through the Sisters and the Imperial Fists and got themselves a ship, what would it earn them? It was madness to think they might approach Terra and demand an audience with the Emperor to vindicate themselves. Any atmosphere-capable ship would be ripped from the sky before it came within sight of the Imperial Palace. And if they fled for deep space, there were hundreds of battleships between Luna and a navigable jump locus. Of all the things he feared would happen to the 70, Nathaniel Garrow had not expected this. To come so far, in measures of both his soul and of distance, only to be held at bay here, within sight of his goal. It was torture in its own way. Time passed, and no word came for them. Sendek wondered aloud if they might be left here to live out their lives while the matter of Horus was settled on the other side of the galaxy, the 70 an inconvenient footnote forgotten amid the fighting. Anders Haker made a joke to him about it, but Garrow saw the real concern beneath the forced humour. Barring death in battle or fatal accident, an Astartes was functionally immortal, and he had heard it said that one of his kind might live 1,000 years or more. Garrow tried to imagine that. being trapped in the citadel while the future unfolded around them, unable to intervene. The Death Guard had attempted to rest for the first few days, but as it was aboard the frigate, sleep came infrequently to him, and when it did, it was brimming with images of darkness and horror, dredged from the madness of the flight. The corrupted, diseased things he had seen masquerading as Grulgor and his men lurked in the shadows of his mind, tearing at his will. Had those things truly been real? The warp was, after all, a reflection of human emotion and psychic turbulence. Perhaps the Grulgor demon was that, a freakish mirror of the black, diseased heart that beat beneath Ignatius's chest made real, a fate that other unwary men could also fall to. At the opposite end of the spectrum, he felt the golden glow of something, someone, impossibly ancient and knowing. It wasn't Keela, although he sensed her as well. It was a light that dwarfed hers, that reached into every corner of his spirit. Finally, he awoke and decided to give up his efforts at sleep. There was a war being fought, he realized, and not just the one out in the Istvan system, the one between those who stood by Horus and those who stood by his father. There was another war, a silent and insidious conflict that only a few were aware of. People like the girl Keela, like Caleb, and now Nathaniel himself. A war not for territory or material gain, but a war for souls and spirits, for hearts and minds. Two paths lay open before him and his kindred. The Astartes understood that they had always been there, but his vision had been clouded and he had not seen them clearly. Along one, the route that Horus had taken, that way lay the monstrous horrors. The other led here, to terror, to the truth and to this new war. It was on that battlefield that Garrow stood, the battle looming ever closer like thunder at the horizon.
"A storm is coming," said the captain to the air,
holding Caleb's brass icon of the Emperor before him. There were always two paths. The first was wet with blood, and he had already stumbled a good way down it. At the end point, always visible but forever out of reach, there was release, painlessness, and the sweet nectar of rebirth. The other route was made of knives, and it was agony and torture and grief without respite, with only greater suffering heaped upon those that already racked his mind and body. There was no conclusion to this route, no oblivion, only an endless loop, a Möbius strip cut from hell. Solon Decius was Astartes, and against an unrefined man among the billions of the Imperium, his kind were the sons of war gods. But even a being of such strength has its limits. The wound grew to become a fanged maw that chewed upon him, biting and drawing his essence from the Death Guard's body. Where Grulgor's plague knife had sunk through his armor and into his flesh, Decius was invaded by a virus that was all viruses, a malady that was every disease that man had encountered, and more that it had yet to face. There was no cure. How could there be? The germs were made from the living distillate of corruption in its rawest form, a writhing pattern of trifold and eight-pointed microbes that disintegrated everything they came into contact with. These invisible weapons were the foot soldiers of the great destroyer, each of them stamped with the indelible mark of the Lord of Decay.
"Help me!"
he would have screamed those words, if only he could have opened his rictus-locked jaws. If he could have parted his dry, gummed lips, if his throat could have channeled anything but a thick paste of blood-darkened mucus. Decius writhed on the support cradle, livid bruises forming about his body where flesh went dull with infection. He clawed at the glass walls around him, arms like brittle sticks in bags of stringy muscle and pallid flesh. Things that looked like maggots with three black eyes bored through the meat of his torso, raking him with tiny whips of poisonous cilia. There was so much pain, and every time Decius imagined he had reached the peaks of each new agony, a fresh one was brought to him. He so wanted death. Nothing else mattered to him. Decius wanted death so much he prayed for it. Imperial truth be damned and burned. He had no other recourse. If peace would not be granted by any source in this world, what entreaty did he have left but to beg the realms beyond the real? From the agony came laughter, mocking at first, then gradually softening, becoming gentle. An intelligence measured him, considering, finally seeing something in the youth, a chance to refine an art only recently discovered, the art of remaking men. Sorrow flowed over him. How terribly sad it was that the men Decius had called brother and lord ignored his pain. How cruel of them to let him suffer and suffer while the malaise burrowed deeper into his heart. He had given so much to them, had he not? Fought in battle at their sides, saved their lives with no thought for his own, become the very best death guard he could be. And for what? So they could seal him inside a glass jar and watch him slowly choke on the fumes of his own decay. Did he deserve this? What wrong had he committed? None. Nothing. They had forsaken him. He hated them for that. Hated them! They had made him weak. Yes, that was the answer. In all this vacillation over Horus and his machinations, Decius had let himself become weak and indecisive. He never would have suffered Grolgor's blow if his mind had been clear and focused. Yes, through the burning pain it became clear. His error traced its roots to one place, to a single point. He had bowed to Garrow's orders. Despite the way in which it chafed upon him, Solon had let himself believe he was still raw and untested, let himself think that Garrow's way was best. But the truth? That was not the truth. Garrow was irresolute. His mentor had lost his killer instinct. Horus. Horus! There was a warrior who knew the nature of strength. He was mighty. He had turned Primarchs to his banner, Mortarian included. Decius thought he could stand against that. What madness must have possessed him.
Do you want death?
The question echoed in him, the agony suddenly abating.
Or will you grasp new life, a new strength that cannot be made vulnerable?
The voice that was no voice whispered, dank and rancid in his thoughts.
Yes! Decius spat bile and black ichor. Yes, damn them all! I will never be weak again. I choose life. Give me life!
The dark laughter returned.
And so I will.
What ripped itself from the Medicaid cradle was no longer Solon Decius, naked and close to the ragged edge of torment. It was alike to an Astartes, but only in the ways that it was a brutal parody of their noble form. Across rotten bones and raw, pustulant skin grew chitinous planes of greenish-black armour, gleaming like spilled oil beneath the light of the biolooms. Eyes that had shriveled to knots of dead jelly erupted into gelid sapphires, multifaceted orbs that massed across a wrecked face and set into the bone. Mandibles joined brown, cracked teeth in the mouth. A stump reached up and batted away the glass rigs of potion bottles, growing and malforming as it did into a clawed limb with too many joints. The serrated fingers inflated and hardened into solid knives of bony carapace, the colour of sword beetles. What was no longer Solon Decius opened its mouth and roared, and from bleeding, suppurating lips spewed a cloud of insects that raced around the shivering body in a living shroud, a cape of beating, swarming wings. On newly clawed feet, the Lord of the Flies raised himself up and shattered the armor-glass walls of his confinement and began a search for something to kill.